Charles Walls versus the City of Peoria.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
Ray. My name is William Allison. I represent the plaintiff and appellant in this case. This is a 42 U.S.C., a civil rights action under 1983.
Sure.
Excessive force under the Fourth Amendment. It comes to the court from summary judgment granted to the defendants by Judge Mills in sitting in Springfield. The facts that we rely on are well established by way of the previous court proceedings. Peoria police officers, the defendants arrested our client, the decedent Pitchford. He put up a struggle to start with. They handcuffed him. He stopped struggling, and 8 or 9 minutes later, he was dead. We think the important facts are that he had stopped struggling. Our claim relates to what happened after he stopped struggling, and everybody agrees that he was no longer a threat to anybody, other officers or the public. We think it is important that these police officers had been trained to know that leaving a person prone in the prone position on his belly, handcuffed behind his back, can lead to sudden lethal consequences. Death.
How long did they lead him that way? 8 or 10 minutes?
I'm sorry, sir?
How long did they, the officers, leave him?
He was left on... let me back up just a little bit. He struggled mightily. He was handcuffed, prone. As soon as he was handcuffed, within seconds he quit struggling. He was then left in that position for 8 minutes until a paddy wagon arrived.
Did an officer have a knee on his back or anything of that sort?
Not during that 8 minute period, Your Honor, no. There is no reply from the officers. Their admissions, they make no explanation for the fact that they had this training, that they had this knowledge, and yet at the scene where this occurred, they didn't use the knowledge that they had. Their training included that they were to, as soon as feasible, take a person off their off their stomach, out of that prone position, and sit them up. And of course, if feasible means, you know, if he still presented some threat, it's not feasible. There was no threat. They admit that. The investigating officer from the Peoria Police Department said after he was handcuffed, he presented no further threat. These facts, we think, distinguish this case substantially from the Phillips case and really take it more to Frizzell versus Flanagan. Frizzell versus Flanagan was a case decided, I think, about 8 months before the Phillips case in late 1996. And that was another case where officers were dealing with a struggling person trying to arrest, and person didn't die, but claimed that he had been injured, and also claimed that he suffered a seizure during the time they were trying to arrest him. And the court in Frizzell made it clear that the jury's verdict could have been supported solely on the idea that there was credible testimony that one of the friends of the person arrested told the officers early in the proceeding that my friend has a seizure problem, has a medical condition. And if the jury believed that, the court felt that was sufficient to require the officer to
counsel. Respond. Is it your theory that laying him prone?
I'm sorry?
Is it your theory that the what the real problem is that they laid him down on his stomach?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
What is your theory?
The constitutional violation, we suggest, is leaving him in that position for 8 minutes, knowing that...
5 to 8 minutes, isn't that what's in the testimony?
Well, that is what Judge Mills states. The officers admitted in their pleadings that it was a period of 8 minutes.
Well, hasn't our circuit held that allowing someone to be in that position without stating any particular time wasn't a violation?
I don't believe that's what Phillips holds, Judge.
Placing a person in a prone position while handcuffed on the floor does not, and in and of itself, violate the Fourth Amendment, quote, and that the use of such technique is not excessive force when the person restrained has been or is resisting arrest.
I think there's two keys to that point.
You're saying resisting arrest.
He can't
resist arrest when you're like that.
Sure. He has stopped
resisting. That's what stops him from it.
He has stopped resisting arrest.
Right.
The other key point is placing him in that position in and of itself. The court goes on in that opinion to say if the officers know of the need for some medical treatment, we might find it objectively unreasonable.
Are you contending that these officers did know it?
Yes. Yes, we are.
How did they know it?
They were trained that any person placed in this position, and they admit it.
Well, I know they were trained that way, yeah. But what is it? So they were trained to that. But they had no knowledge that he had any problem, did they?
It isn't a matter of problems, Your Honor. The cause of death in this case was restraint, was death due to asphyxiation by restraint. There is nothing in the record to show that he had this thyroid storm like the person being arrested had in Phillips. There's nothing to show that he had any pre-existing medical condition. The only thing that he had was he had been struggling with them previous to being handcuffed. And that, of course, is going to drain him of energy and oxygen to some extent.
Do you think that they shouldn't restrain him or what?
Oh, absolutely. Our claim starts at the time he quit resisting arrest. And the Phillips case makes that distinction. Phillips case says they went on to analyze what happened after he was restrained.
But now, in this case, wasn't one of the officers monitoring him while he was down on the ground?
Your Honor, she was sitting there beside him with her hand on his sweatshirt. That's true. Watching him. But she was watching him knowing that they had placed him in a position that can lead to sudden death.
But did they have any reason whatsoever to think that Mr. Pitchford was actually in distress?
Was what, ma'am?
Was actually in distress.
Well, his face was full of mucus. He was breathing through the mucus in his mouth and nose, bubbles. In the mucus was what was showing that he was still breathing. And as the evidence...
But isn't that the key?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that the key? The fact that
he was breathing.
He was conscious.
Sure, it's the key. They could have saved his life. They were taught when you're in this position, when it's feasible, you sit somebody up. And State Trooper Toby Pleasant, who teaches this at the Illinois State Police Academy, says, once the person has stopped struggling, there's no reason to leave them on their stomach. And if there's no reason for something, we're suggesting it's unreasonable. They left him there for no reason, knowing that...
You're into your rebuttal time.
Yes, sir. Yeah. I thank you.
Okay.
Please the court. My name is Randall Ray. I'm Corporation Counsel for the City of Peoria. It's my privilege today to represent Peoria police officers Jennifer Beckman, Amanda Chalice, and Douglas Hopwood. I regret that I must begin by pointing out an error on page 3 of our brief and our statement of facts. We inadvertently said that after finding no pulse, Officer Hopwood began CPR in less than 10 minutes. It's correct and uncontested that it was less than 2 minutes.
Less than 2 minutes.
Right, and we apologize for that error.
What page was that on?
Page 3 of our brief, pardon, in our statement of facts. The Phillips case, which has already been brought up by the court, is the controlling authority in this case.
You know, it probably is, but is this case distinct from Phillips in the sense that Mr.
I'm fine, go ahead. Sorry.
That's okay. That Mr. Pitchford stopped resisting the officers within seconds after he was handcuffed. That's the difference here, isn't it?
I don't believe so. I don't think the evidence in Phillips is that Mr. Phillips was he was on the floor, but in that case, the plaintiffs were attempting to allege that he was motionless for 5 minutes. So I don't think that's a distinction. I think there are some other distinctions that make this case an even more surprising turn of events. No one wanted this person to die, and we're all sorry that he died. But of the known factors in Phillips, you had considerable obesity, and you had medical testimony that obesity can cause problems with breathing in the prone position. Here we have a man who is 5'7", 165 pounds. Not obese, an uncontested fact. And again, Phillips says restraining a person in a prone position with constant monitoring cannot be considered, characterized in itself as deadly force. Not a substantial likelihood of death. The prone position while handcuffed on the floor does not in itself violate the Fourth Amendment. And furthermore, then they turn their attention to the conduct of the officers in monitoring the subject while he's on the ground. And the court in Phillips concluded again that no one noticed Phillips not getting enough oxygen cannot, standing alone, transform these officers' actions into a transgression of constitutional magnitude. In this case, we have the same type of monitoring, constant contact with his clothing, watching him. His face was turned toward the officer who was monitoring him. We have an uncontested fact, plaintiff's fact, 19. Decedent was conscious until he was picked up to be placed in the transport wagon. His movements indicated that he was not lifeless or unconscious or anything of that nature. This brings us to this question of the 8 minutes. There are 8 minutes on the log between the time that they radioed to bring the wagon and the time that they radioed for an ambulance, finding no pulse. There were things that were happening during that time. The transport wagon arrived. Leg shackles were placed on this person. He was stood up. He was found to be lifeless. He was then put back down on the ground, checked for pulse, none found, and the radio transmission went out for an ambulance. The important thing is that Phillips did not find the officers not liable on the basis of qualified immunity. They found the officers not liable because what they did not constitute a constitutional violation. When a reasonable district judge read that case, he came to the indisputable conclusion that any law requiring somebody to be repositioned after being handcuffed prone on the ground was not clearly established. Therefore, any police officer would come to the same conclusion from a reading of Phillips, that there is no hard and fast constitutional right to be placed in a different position. Now, the plaintiff would have you start this case at the time that the decedent was handcuffed and stopped struggling. But one has to look at the totality of circumstances. The plaintiff's complaint says he resisted violently. Having resisted violently, the officers reasonably concluded that they needed to put to keep him in a position where he could be controlled. There has never been an admission in this case that a handcuffed subject is not a threat. I would suggest that any time a police officer is on the street, everyone is always a threat. Obviously, you handcuff them to reduce that threat, but to sit them up or stand them up gives them greater leverage, greater opportunity to resume the struggle. And it's not required. There's been reference to the comments of Toby Pleasant, and I think that we should make it clear that in his summary, and he wasn't our expert, he was the state trooper's expert, but in his summary opinion, he stated that based on the totality of circumstances confronting officers, the control and arrest techniques were not excessive or unreasonable considering the resistance and combative nature of Mr. Pitchford. Plaintiff has placed great weight on his statement of fact 50, which pertains to a statement made in his deposition, taken out of context, a statement that we replied to as being irrelevant. And it's based on Pleasant's deposition at 22. And here's the question. Why do you turn the person over once you're convinced that basically there is no safety problem for the officer? That's not talking about this case, and it's assuming the safety of the officer. And the answer is answer, why do we? Question, right? Answer, I want to roll them to check their front part of their body for any kind of weapons to assess if there is any more of a threat level for the officer. Then we want to set them in an upright position. There is really no reason to leave them in a prone position once the aggression stops. It's that last sentence that they put so much weight on, but it's an answer to a question that assumes that the officer's safety is established. Here, we had a very combative individual who put up a mighty struggle, and these officers reasonably believed that it was not necessary and not proper to put him in a position where he would have greater leverage to resume the struggle. These officers are clearly entitled to qualified immunity. Officer Pleasant, not their expert, says that that their actions were reasonable. A reasonable officer could certainly have believed that prone restraint with constant monitoring was not only constitutional but rational in this case based on the amount of the struggle. Under Sauchet, an officer would even be entitled to qualified immunity if he reasonably mistakenly believed that keeping them in a prone position was reasonable. And beyond that, we get to an irrefutable point that any such right to be sat up or right not to be prone for any set period of time, regardless of how you've struggled, was clearly not established at the time that these officers were responding. Let me just say,
is it clearly established now or something later?
No, it's not clearly established now. If these officers are found liable, I believe that these would be the first officers in a reported opinion to be found liable for restraining someone in a prone position, with the exception of hog tying cases, and this is most definitely not a hog tying case. With regard to the training, there is evidence that they were trained to get the person up when feasible. There is no evidence that they were trained that no matter what the person did after 2 minutes or after 3 minutes, they're entitled to be sat up. And then I suppose we'd go on, and if they struggled then, we'd put them back, and then after another couple minutes, they'd have a right to get back up again. This is an unfortunate occurrence. It was unforeseeable. There was no knowledge on the part of these defendants of any medical condition that this man had, making him particularly susceptible. He wasn't overweight. They only knew that he resisted. They monitored him closely, and at all times he was breathing. He was breathing right up until the time they picked him up. These officers certainly had no basis to send a medical or send for medical care. So for all these reasons, these officers did not violate Mr. Pitchford's constitutional rights, and if they would somehow be found to have done so, they would certainly be entitled to qualified immunity. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right.
Phillips Court relied on the Gutierrez case from the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit, in deciding that case, was trying to deal with the question of what information the officers had, what their knowledge was, what their policy was in their police department. The quote that we have on page 19 from Gutierrez says, "This dispute is important because it may be difficult to conclude that the officers acted reasonably if they performed an action which had been banned by their department or of whose dangers in the circumstances they had been warned."
So how does that fit with this case?
These officers had been warned.
Been warned of what?
That if they put a person in a prone position, handcuffed behind his back, that may lead to sudden lethal consequences. That is established in our statement of facts. They were told that in their training, not only by the Peoria Police Department, but the Illinois State Police Training Academy. They were warned of that.
All right, counsel. Thank you.
You bet. I appreciate it, Steve.
Thank you very much. Thank you.